This is Ukraine Calling, a weekly roundup of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main story. I'm Marta Dechok for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here are the headlines that caught my attention this week.
The reason it's become so difficult is that because the Russian state does not want to really recognize Ukrainian sovereignty, it wants to block all aspects of a sovereign church in Ukraine.
Для того, щоб держава відчувала себе впевненою, треба, щоб була одна церква, незалежна від будь-кого, а насамперед від Москви.
Вогник благодатного вогню ми отримали з Константинополя, звідки прибули до нас перші єпіскопи-священники. З цар города Христова віра прийшла до Києва на береги Дніпра, і вже саме звідси поширилася на інші східнослов'янські терени та сусідні народи.
And these are very, very important issues, especially today, when Ukraine finds itself in a very serious conflict with Russia, a war with Russia, where those churches have seemed to be taking sides.
Orthodox pilgrims filled Kyiv city center this week. Two separate marches were held. One was organized by the Moscow Patriarchate of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, the other by the Kyiv Patriarchate of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. There were fears that violence would break out, so thousands of police were brought out into the streets, main avenues were closed to traffic, metal detectors were installed close to the site where the pilgrims were headed. It was the statue of Prince Vladimir the Great, which stands in a beautiful park in the city center, overlooking the Dnipro River. Prince Vladimir brought Christianity to Kyiv and Rus back in 988. This is celebrated every year on the 28th of July, the name day for Vladimir. Despite the fears and inconvenienced for city commuters in Kyiv, both pilgrimages were peaceful. Religion and politics can be a volatile mix, especially when two countries are at war, like Ukraine and Russia are today. To explain why religion is a site of conflict between Ukraine and Russia, not only today, but historically, we'll have an explanation from the Moscow Patriarchate of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, an in-depth commentary with two experts later in the show. War continues in the Donbas. July saw an escalation in hostilities, unlike anything since last summer. Over the past week, 11 Ukrainian soldiers were killed and 27 were wounded. The deadliest day was Sunday.
Донецький напрямок. Минулої доби географія бойових дій дещо розширилася.
In Donetsk area, during the last 24 hours, the geography of the military actions a little bit broadened. And they renewed active military actions at the front line Troitsk, Lugansk, Zaitsevo and Mayorsk.
One soldier also died as a result of an accident at the Shirokiy Lan military base in the Kherson region. On Tuesday, Ukraine's President Poroshenko held a phone conversation with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. They discussed the continued violations of the Minsk agreements. The next day, the Minsk contact group met, and once again, they were unable to reach agreement on any issues. Nadiya Savchenko, Ukraine's pilot turned politician, came up with a radical proposal for seeking peace and was widely criticized for it. 2 months after being released from Russian prison, she was once again on live television in Ukraine. At one point, she looked into the camera and appealed directly to the leaders of the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. She addressed Alexander Zakharchenko and Igor Plotnitsky by name. She invited them personally to negotiate for a peace settlement and to release prisoners. She also called for all sides to apologize to the mothers whose sons had been killed. Russian President Putin has been pushing to include the DNR and LNR in negotiations, while Ukraine has been refusing. Some Ukrainian politicians are now calling Savchenko a Trojan horse. Two men tried to pelt her with eggs when she addressed a crowd in Odessa. Ukraine's government was busy this week. One of the decisions they made was that all government officials will now be required to report their income electronically. This is viewed as a way of increasing transparency and rooting out corruption. Prime Minister Groysman welcomed the move, but added that the requirement should be extended to politicians as well. Ukraine's education ministry is stepping up the fight against plagiarism by using technology. This week, Minister Lilia Hrinavich announced that in partnership with Microsoft Ukraine, they would be launching a new unified academic database this September. The goal is to have a national repository of academic texts so that new work can be checked to see if it really is original. Ukraine, like all post-Soviet countries, continues to suffer from endemic plagiarism that was commonplace in the past. The last education minister, Serhiy Kvit, began the process of creating the electronic database. Ukrainians also got a new health minister this week, American-born Dr. Ulana Suprun. She came to Ukraine when the Euromaidan protest began in 2013 and worked as a medical volunteer. Then war broke out in the Donbas, so she created and headed up an NGO called Patriot Defense. They began providing individual first aid kits and training soldiers in first aid medicine at a time when the Ukrainian state wasn't doing enough in that sphere. Ukraine's previous health minister, Roman Vasilishin, was recently dismissed for bribery. Suprun was appointed acting minister, and there are high hopes that she will introduce the much-needed reforms in the country's health sphere. Hromadske Radio was the first in Ukraine to report that renowned Canadian historian Otis Subtelny passed away earlier this week. The story got picked up by many major media outlets, and by midday, the country's president had issued a statement of condolences to family and friends. Subtelny is a household name in Ukraine. His textbook, Ukraine, A History, shaped an entire generation. It was the first readable textbook on Ukrainian history in English. It appeared in 1988 and was published by the University of Toronto Press. Within a few years, Ukraine became independent and threw out all the old Soviet textbooks that were filled with ideology. The new country chose Subtelny's book to teach Ukrainian history from and translated it into Ukrainian and Russian. It continues to be a bestseller decades later. Explaining why religion can be seen as a battlefield between Ukraine and Russia, how history has shaped this struggle, and why it's relevant today, we spoke with three people. Representative of Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate, Daniel Bilak, a Canadian lawyer who now lives in Kyiv and who has acted a facilitator for the Orthodox churches in Ukraine for 25 years. That conversation was recorded on the 28th of July, the day the second pilgrimage was happening. And Professor Frank Sisson, who is director of the Peter Yatsik Center for Historical Research at the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies. We reached Denis Luzinski, staff member of the Department for External Church Relations of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate by phone. Mr. Luzinski, thank you for speaking to us. Can you please explain to our listeners why your church organized a pilgrim march in Kyiv this week?
Okay, thank you for having me. Actually, to start, I'd like to mention that it's not a pilgrimage, but it's named the Holy Cross Procession, and it has a very ancient tradition behind itself. It's a pretty ancient form of joint prayer that's been practiced by the Orthodox Christian Church for over a millennium. In fact, it takes its origins from the late 4th century, and since that time, has become popular and quite widespread over the Christian world. The procession is organized with different purposes, although all of them are united under one goal, to gather together and to raise a prayer to God in a joint voice. In most cases, the procession is a prayer to God for something extraordinary and highly important that touches all the people of society. In history, we can find a lot of cases when a Holy Cross procession was carried in the time of natural disasters and wars. And always, the purpose of the procession is the only one, a joint, wholehearted prayer. And not a demonstration of a prayer, but in some ways an invitation to join and pray together, because we all go under God and everything is in His hands. So as you can see, there hasn't been anything new happening lately here in Ukraine. Such processions are pretty normal and widespread forms of prayer over all the Christian Orthodox world. And of course, here in Ukraine, in Kyivska Rus, Christians have been using this form of prayer for centuries. So the Holy Cross procession that has finished lately gathered together thousands of Ukrainians. We have information about over 80,000 people who participated in the procession in different places of its route. People united by one faith, one hope, and one desire to stop war in the east of Ukraine, and with this in their hearts, to pray to God for His mercy, to bring peace to our motherland Ukraine, love and mutual understanding into human hearts and minds.
Our guest this evening is Daniel Bilak, who is a Canadian and a lawyer and has been living and working in Ukraine for 25 years. And he has also been advising Orthodox churches on autocephalacy during his time here in Kyiv. Thank you very much for joining us. Mr. Bilak, let's start with this week there were two pilgrimage marches in the center of Kyiv. And city streets were closed off. There was a lot of extra security. Could you explain to our listeners why there were two pilgrimage marches?
Well, we have, for historical reasons, we have essentially at least three main Orthodox churches
in Ukraine.
We have the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate, which is tied to the Russian Orthodox Church, the Moscow Patriarchate. We have the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Kyiv Patriarchate, which is not recognized by other Orthodox churches, whereas the Moscow Patriarchate is, and the Ukrainian Autocephalous Orthodox Church, which has now become a very small part of the complexity that is Ukrainian Orthodoxy today. And this is all about showing Ukrainians sort of who has support and who doesn't. We've gone through an enormous transformation in this country in the Orthodox Church since independence, when the single Orthodox Church in the country was tied to the Russian Orthodox Church. There was a split in 1992, which created the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Kyiv Patriarchate, which sort of became the Ukrainian patriotic, if you like, branch. It held its liturgies in Ukrainian, its sermons in Ukrainian, and became much more tied up with the whole identity politics in the country, which is we're still struggling with in Ukraine. So this was a way to show Ukrainians when the Moscow Patriarchate had its pilgrimage march. It had two, actually, one starting in Kharkiv and marching on Kyiv, the other one starting in Ternopil at the Pochayinska Lavra Monastery, Pochayev Monastery in Ternopilska Oblast. And these were designed to show Ukrainians across the country the strength and the popularity, if you like, of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate. Today's pilgrimage march by the Ukrainian Orthodox Church Kyiv Patriarchate is traditionally held on July 28th, which is now the day of the anniversary of the baptism of Kyiv and Rus by Prince Volodymyr the Great. And that usually attracts a very, very large crowd.
So these are symbolic.
They're very, very different messages, I think. One is all about canonicity and belonging to the Orthodox world and the connection to the Moscow Patriarchate. And the other one is about the reassertion and the validation of a Ukrainian identity in a religious sense. And these are very, very important issues, especially today when Ukraine finds itself in a very serious conflict with Russia, a war with Russia, where those churches have seen to be taking sides.
Were you able to go to either of the marches? And if you were there, could you just explain, were they different? And if they were different, how were they different?
I felt the march from the Moscow Patriarchate because I had to take the metro in. I usually drive into work to Kyiv in the morning.
Let me explain to our listeners what Mr. Bilak is referring to. Many of the streets in central Kyiv were blocked off during the march of the Moscow Patriarchate, and thousands of extra police were put on the streets to safeguard security. There were fears of provocations, and people were expecting that there might be some violence. I actually went to the one on the 27th because it's in my neighborhood, and there was no violence. So there was a lot of police presence, a lot of people that were not actually marching. They were driving up in SUVs and buses. But people who work in the city center had to take public transit to work. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
That's fine. I think that coming back to your question, that I did not partake in the Moscow Patriarchate March. I was walked with the people in the Kiev Patriarch March because it passes right in front of my office. The last 2 years have really fundamentally altered the calculus, both the political and the religious calculus, surrounding this conflict between the Orthodox churches. The Moscow Patriarchate counts numbers of churches, hence this building spree that it's been on for the last 25 years to build as many churches across the country as possible. I mean, what a lot of people don't appreciate is that the Russian Orthodox Church, which sort of the underpins the Moscow Patriarchate, if you like, claims to be the largest church in Orthodoxy by number of parishioners and parishes, actually, by number of parishes. And that's very true. What is not appreciated is that more than half of those churches are in Ukraine. And this is why the number of buildings, the number of churches actually counts. Whereas because of the relative positions taken by the churches in this conflict, with the Moscow Patriarchate supporting or at least remaining highly visibly neutral in the conflict, but the Kyiv Patriarchate having provided actually sanctuary to the students on the night of November 30th when they were beaten by the Berkut at St. Michael's of the Golden Dome.
This was during the Euromaidan.
During the Euromaidan, has been front and center of saying, you know, we need our own church, we support Ukraine, we support the army. At its own expense, it's been providing chaplains to the army, etc. So there's very, very, very different. And feel to the and perception in the population, which really didn't understand to a large extent the difference between the different churches. It was all Orthodox because they were all called Ukrainian Orthodox Church. They didn't think about the patriarchate part. However, this issue is very important because today people do understand the difference because of the positions that the priests and the bishops have had to take, been forced to take by events. And the vast majority of people, if you look at the opinion polls, if you look at the surveys that have been taken, very authoritative surveys as well, by people from outside the country, not just Ukrainian polling firms, that show over 50%, almost 60% in favor of the Kyiv Patriarchate.
Which is a huge change from 10 years ago.
Well, it's in fact almost reversed the numbers to almost, you know, 15% for the Moscow Patriarchate, which is a sea change in terms of perception. And this, of course, is what's driving today. And the president views this he's been very open about this. He views this as a national security issue. The two marches are very different in the sense that, and they reflect the underlying values of the two churches, I think, as well. The pilgrimage march of the Moscow Patriarchate was very much for believers of the Moscow Patriarchate. It was a show of strength. It's a show of numbers. We are still large and in charge, as we historically have been. Continuity, nothing's changed, etc. Whereas the proceedings today, especially the official proceedings, because the pilgrimage march of the Kyiv Patriarchate was not part of the official proceedings, but the official proceedings dovetailed as well, I think, with the Kyiv Patriarchate's overall approach, which is very ecumenical. Patriarch Filaret has an excellent relationship with Patriarch Sviatoslav of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. He has an excellent relationship with the chief rabbi and the chief imam of Ukraine. And they all work together in the All-Ukrainian Council of Churches.
And I believe they were all there today.
And the Moscow Patriarchate is very much of this is our territory. You must all be Orthodox. If you're not Orthodox, then you have to know your place and don't make too much noise. You look at the laws that Putin has just passed in Russia, which are profoundly disturbing in terms of the freedom of expression, freedom of religion, and freedom of religious expression as well. The Kyiv Patriarchate, because it has an outward-looking view, is much more ecumenical. It's much more European in its approach. It's Occidentalist as opposed to Orientalist. And it's making a very... This is where we get into the crux of the matter. It's making the explicit point that our Orthodoxy, Ukrainian Orthodoxy, comes from Constantinople. It doesn't come from Moscow. And this is where this is the subtext of the two marches. And this is where the whole issue of autocephaly comes in, which is the independence of a church. In unlike Catholicism, Roman Catholicism, Orthodoxy is somewhat decentralized. You have the Patriarch of Constantinople, who was a first among equals, but historically each country has its own Orthodox church. And Ukraine did not for many, many years.
Basically, what the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, the Kyiv Patriarchate, they want, if we put it in layman's terms, independence.
They want a Ukrainian local church, an independent Ukrainian local church.
And where would that leave the Moscow Patriarchate?
That would leave, it's unlikely in the... at this stage that we will have a single unified church, because Moscow will never allow that. Moscow will never relinquish its claim to the Ukrainian lands, because that means that Moscow will lose most of its authority in Orthodoxy. It'll be about the size of the Romanian church.
Thank you. The fact that both of these marches were held very peacefully was something that a lot of people were pleasantly surprised. There was all this speculation in advance, all this extra police presence on the streets, setting up cordons and metal detectors. What do you think that says about what's going on in a country at war, that it has this complex, tense issue, and yet it goes very smoothly and peacefully?
I think it shows a number of things. I think it shows, first and foremost, that people are concerned about a lot of other things other than, you know, pilgrimage marches. They were well received in when they were marching. The Moscow Patriarchate march in the east was certainly better received than it was in the west. It was, I think, more of an irritation in some places. But they people had the right. People joined in each of those towns and cities. They could walk through. Ukraine is a pretty tolerant place, notwithstanding that the religious conflicts over the past 25 years have been about property as much as they have been about canonicity.
And there have been incidents of violence in the past over religious issues.
Yeah, but remember, there are a lot of provocateurs as well, perhaps on both sides. And
and this week that didn't happen.
Well, there were some provocations by so-called Ukrainian nationalists against the Moscow Patriarchate March. But by and large, the government and the president deserve a lot of credit for bending over backwards to ensure that they could march and that both churches could march. The president has been very clear on his position that he wants to see autocephaly for a Ukrainian church and that he would like to see it on the basis of the Kyiv Patriarchate. He respected the rights of his citizens to express their own views.
Thank you very much for joining us and explaining a very complicated subject in a very clear way. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
With us, we have Professor Frank Sisson, who is the director of the Petro Yatsik Center for Historical Research at the University of Alberta. Professor Sisson joins us by telephone from Toronto. Thank you very much for finding the time to talk to us. This week in Kyiv, there were two pilgrim marches of Orthodox believers in central Kyiv. And what I would like to ask you to help our listeners understand is, why is religion such an important battlefield between Ukraine and Russia historically?
religion is an important part of this battlefield because religion is also interconnected with identity, with historical traditions, and above all, with an ongoing dispute or difficulty as to whether there are two differing religious traditions on the territory of contemporary Ukraine and Russia, or are they one tradition? And above all, should they be one church and in a way one civilizational zone, which we might call from the Russian perspective the Ruski Mir, that is the Russian world. Now, why do I say this has been a long-term difficulty? Because the church that was begun from Byzantium that came to the city of Kyiv developed an ecclesiastical structure or church over a huge territory of Eastern Europe in the Middle Ages over many different kinds of peoples and languages. It did it through a language culture that was Church Slavonic, neither Russian nor Ukrainian. In fact, Church Slavonic is closest to the South Slavic languages, contemporary Bulgarian or Macedonian. And that religious culture, which existed in the Middle Ages, is in many ways the formation of both modern Ukrainian and modern Russian culture. But from the very beginning, this huge church that is created based out of Kyiv is much too big in its territory to really be effectively administered. And from the Middle Ages, from the very beginning on, there were tendencies to divide that entity up. And what we can say is by the 14th and 15th century, two very differing religious traditions develop. One in Kyiv and to the areas of Ukraine, particularly in Western Ukraine, a tradition that saw itself as closely related to the ancient Kyiv tradition. And then in many ways, a new offshoot in the north based on the territories of Suzdalia, the territories now around Moscow. And these entities then broke off into separate churches in the 15th century. They were both Orthodox churches, but for over 200 years, they were in differing states, they had differing cultural traditions, and above all, the church, the Orthodox Church in Ukraine, based on the Slavonic culture, was also interconnected with the Western Christian world and with many new tendencies and thought processes that did not really influence the Russian church of this period. And then after the political act of 1654, when Khmelnytsky swore allegiance to the Tsar, there was a tendency to try and impose the rule of the newly created Patriarchate of Moscow, which was only created in 1589, over the Metropolitan See of Kyiv. And that in 1686 is enacted in an act which many in the Ukrainian church today view as uncanonical, and created what was the Imperial Russian Orthodox Church. And that was the church of the imperial tradition, greatly transformed in the times of Peter I, almost created into a non-Orthodox church as the patriarch is abolished, that goes all the way down to 1917 and the breakdown of the Russian Empire. And much of the 20th century religious history of this territory has been one in which a movement to form a specific Ukrainian Orthodox Church has attempted to set up its independence from the Russian Orthodox Church. So in many ways, the Ukrainian church issue in the Eastern world is already over a century old. That is, the striving in a modern period to form a Ukrainian Orthodox Church. But in many ways, culturally, civilizationally, one of the important aspects is, does one see a Ukrainian, organic Ukrainian religious tradition coming out of Kyiv and Rus having its own specificity, or does one see it as part of a Russian church, which in many ways has taken over many of the aspects of Russian state and political culture? And those two processes contend to this day. And they are now extremely influential at a time when one has an independent Ukrainian church, independent Ukrainian state, but one in which in many ways Russia does not fully accept as an independent Ukrainian state, and in which religious institutions, which have revived greatly in Ukraine, after the periods of the Soviet persecutions, have become very important in influencing culture and society in Ukraine.
What role does the church and the religious conflict play in the military conflict, the hybrid war that's going on in Ukraine right now?
Well, what we can say is that in many ways, the Patriarchate of Moscow, which cooperates closely with the Russian government, has what might be called soft power. It is in many ways the last great imperial institution and tries still to exercise its influence over the territory of the former Soviet Union and even farther beyond it. And therefore, once an ideology of the so-called Russian world, that is the concept that Russia also had a say over the fate of territories in which there were Russian speakers or that were formerly part of the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union, once that ideology was created, in many ways in tandem between the Russian church and the Russian state, it was set on a collision course with a Ukraine which wanted to be a European state, a fully sovereign state, and one in which the Ukrainian state also was interested in the preservation of Ukrainian culture as well as the rights of all of its groups and minorities. And so one of the Russian foreign policy and the policy of the Russian church has done everything it can to ensure that that a Ukrainian Orthodox church not be set up, which is fully recognized by the Orthodox world as canonical, and hence that's caused the current split in Ukraine. This is not an unusual circumstance. The creating in new states or newly formed states of autocephalous or independent Orthodox churches and traditions has often been much disputed, in which the so-called mother church struggles against it. Indeed, when the Russian Orthodox Church in the 15th century became autocephalous, it wasn't recognized for a good 140 or 50 years. Similar things happened in Bulgaria. And what we're now seeing is a working out of this process. It's not only in Ukraine that this occurs. This occurs, for example, today between the Serbian Church and the Church of Macedonia. So these are very difficult ecclesiastical problems of how one forms an independent Orthodox Church recognized as fully member of the Orthodox community. The reason it's become so difficult is that because the Russian state does not want to really recognize Ukrainian sovereignty, it wants to block all aspects of a sovereign church in Ukraine. And the other side of this is there are considerable groups in Ukraine, particularly in the hierarchy of what once was the Russian Orthodox Church and now is the Ukrainian Orthodox Church that is under the Moscow Patriarchate, that really do not accept as well Ukrainian sovereignty or Ukraine as a independent state with a relationship with Russia as with any other independent state. And these also involve cultural traditions, that is the kind of traditions that they see themselves as part of. And that reluctance has created a crisis in Ukrainian religious culture, in Ukrainian culture generally. And we have now seen it emerge in the time of conflict between Ukraine and Russia in many ways. First of all, the reports we have had that the church in the areas of Donbass and in Crimea, at least clergy from the church who have intervened on the side of separatists or in Russia in these conflicts. Even more important for all of Ukraine, at the moment, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, as in the prayers it puts out, wants to portray in many ways this conflict as a civil war internally in Ukraine. That is, adopting the line of the Russian government that there is not a Russia intervening in Ukrainian affairs. And as well, as we have recently seen, with the March of Peace that was established by this church to come on the day of St. Volodymyr, this in many ways would call for peace, but that peace is being called for on one side, on the Ukrainian side. We see no such movement in the Russian church in Russia to attempt to convince the Russian government to stop its intervention.
Professor Sisson, you're a historian. I'm wondering if I could get you to comment a little bit about geopolitics. Constantinople, to remind our listeners, is located in Turkey. And Turkey has, in the last little while, started a sort of rapprochement with Russia. How will this affect the religious issue?
So the Constantinople Patriarchate, still in now in Istanbul, is a much reduced, very small group of believers, but it has still the patriarch there, and that has been the strength of the of that church. And as the primate of all orthodoxy, the Constantinople Patriarchate has considerable constituencies, for example, in North America. Now, the issue is, will the Turkish government intervene in these affairs? The Turkish government has in many ways used the Christian believers, both the Orthodox and the Armenian Apostolic believers, as, let's say, a pawn in international relations. It has given them more autonomy in periods in which it has wanted to move closer to Europe and to join the European community. Obviously, if it turns away from this, it will respond very differently. The decisions made by the Turkish government as to its relations with, above all, Moscow, and because of that also with Kyiv, will, I think, influence the government's policy in these affairs. But I think Constantinople, the Patriarchate and Patriarch Bartholomew, now must think in broader and international terms and constituencies when informing these policies. So yes, all of these are part of an international political game as well. There is no question the Russian government will try and prevail on the Turkish government to influence Constantinople and how it acts. The question is how Constantinople will proceed. And, of course, if Turkey turns towards Ukraine, one might see a differing policy. I think the internal church affairs are much more important than what the Turkish government would do at the moment in these affairs. I really do think that we have reached a point where it'll partially be resolved within Ukraine. Until now, I think the great issue in Ukraine has been, well, the majority or a large constituency by all polls and surveys we have of believers are ready to go over to the Kyiv Patriarchate. The clergy was much more reluctant to make this decision, and above all, the bishops of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. So we have real dissension between now a population which in Ukraine would seemingly favor an independent or a pomisna Ukrainian church, a clergy much more reluctant, and as well bishops who still seem to think in the conceptualization of the Russian world. There are various constituencies within the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate, but the fact that its metropolitan has, for example, recently tried to halt holding religious services in Ukrainian, or at least that this would not spread as a movement, as we saw the reluctance or the unwillingness of them to stand to honor those who died in the struggle for Ukraine that all of Ukraine saw, shows that the church hierarchy is extremely conservative and, many would argue, is still very tied to Moscow and to the Kremlin, that is, both to the Russian Orthodox Church, but also to the Russian government.
Professor Sisson, thank you very much for joining us and explaining an extremely complicated subject, both in a historical context and why it's relevant in Ukraine and Russia today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For those of you thinking of traveling to Ukraine, there are many cool restaurants to enjoy. Ostanya Barikada, the last barricade, recently opened in central Kyiv. It's just under the Maidan and it's a little hard to find. You need to know the password to get in, but it's worth the effort. Inside, you'll find a contemporary space with a stylized folk flavor. The food can best be described as fusion, traditional Ukrainian food with a modern twist. For example, varendiki with halva, topped with pomegranate berries, served on a rolling pin that's been cut in half. There's also sofra in Kyiv's Pechetk neighborhood, which serve traditional Crimean Tatar food in an elegant space filled with their art and rugs. If your travels take you to the Odessa region, restaurateur Dmitro Sikorsky recommends that you visit Shabsky Dvorik in the Shabo village, where he says is the best authentic Bessarabian cuisine. Mariupol, just a few kilometers from a war zone, has a trendy new cafe. Refugees from Donetsk moved their izba hangout to the region's acting capital. They reopened it recently in what is now called Prospekt Miru, the Peace Boulevard, the main street that until recently had Lenin's name. High ceilings, white walls, mellow music, high-speed internet, good coffee, and pleasant service will greet you there. You don't need to travel to Ukraine to enjoy its contemporary music. This week, I'd like to play you something composed and performed by Anton Besonny. He lives in Horluka. It's in what Ukraine calls occupied territories of Donetsk. Anton wrote this in 2014, when the war was just starting. He called the composition Litnyi Hrad, which means hail in summer, but there's a wordplay. Hrad means hail, but it's also the name of mortar rockets that have been attacking Horluka from the sky, particularly over the last week. Thank you. Next week, the Olympic Games begin in Rio. Ukraine's team is already there, so we'll be following their performances and all the other news. Tune in next week for a new episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Marta Dichok in Kyiv. Let me know what you think at mail@hromadskeradio.org. Thanks for listening.